Said was, in the same way that zina is something which is haram, everyone knows, there is no ambiguity about what is zina. No one can make any doubt or any loophole or anything. It's something which is mutlaqan haram. There is no ifs or buts or anything about it. That way, tatbir is haram according to those who are with the rahbah, right? I wanted to say that deliberately because I didn't want to allow any ambiguity to come in. I did not for a second, God is my witness. I did not say for a second, the recordings are my witness, that zina is tatbir, a'udhu billah. The two are completely different things. They are not connected in any shape, way or form. They are both completely disconnected things. Right? I used the word zina, that was a mistake on my part. And I accept that I made a mistake. I am not an infallible, I am a small student. And all of us, we make errors of judgment. My reasoning, My reasoning was there, but my reasoning was not correct. And that is my mistake. My opinion is that of my marja and the wali faqih. And I will read it for you if you give me permission.
Please go ahead.
It is question number 1450 from the Istifta'at book of Ayatollah al-Udhma Sayyid Ali al-Husayni al-Khamenei. The question is hitting oneself with swords halal if it is done in secret? Or is your fatwa in this regard universal? This is the question that was asked. The answer that Ayatollah Khamenei gave is as follows, and I'm going to read it word for word. In addition to the fact that it is not held in the common view as manifestations of mourning and grief, and it has no precedent in the lifetime of the Imams alayhim as-salam, and even after that, and we have not received any tradition quoted from the infallibles alayhim as-salatu was-salam, any support for this act, be it private or public, this practice would, at the present time, give others a bad image of our school of thought. Therefore, there is no way that it can be considered permissible. There is no way. This is not my opinion. Shabir is nobody. This is the opinion of Imam Khamenei. Today, the situation in the Muslim world, in the world generally, is different to what it was, say, 100 years ago. It's different. Now the world is much smaller. Everything is much closer to each other. Right? This is normal. Everyone knows this. Everyone accepts this. Therefore, Allah gave us something called Wilayat al-Faqih. When we had the victory of the Islamic Revolution in Iran, this idea of Wilayat al-Faqih was established. The idea wasn't created by Imam Khomeini. The idea was there from the time of Imam Mahdi, from back in the day. It's not a new idea. But it wasn't possible to apply it because the circumstances were not in place. Before Wilayat al-Faqih, we had lots of senior maraja and ulama, mujtahideen, in various cities across different parts of the Muslim world. And mainly in the West, there was hardly any Muslims. For example, Imam Khomeini, for the sister of Sharif, his father used to live in Kashmir, and he was known as Ayatollah al-Hindi. This is very well known, it's famous. He used to live in a village in Kashmir, and he was the Qazi or the Hakim Shah for that village. There were other ulama in that village, of course, but he was the Hakim Shah. If there was an issue, if there was a question, someone said something or did something, or whatever the case might be, the Hakim Shah would be consulted, and whatever the Hakim Shah said, even though the other person was a mujtahid, whatever the Hakim Shah said was overpowering, regardless of what the issue was. Wilayat al-Faqih is an extension of this subject on a global scale, right? Of course, I'm simplifying because I'm trying to answer the question, but essentially, this is what Wilayat al-Faqih is. In Wilayat al-Faqih, you have the Hakim Shah, which at the moment, we have Imam Khamenei as the Hakim Shah. When the Hakim Shah makes a ruling, it is different. His understanding of the ruling and why the ruling is being made is different to the way when a marja makes that ruling. There is a reason for that. When the marja is asked a question, the marja looks at the issue of that person in, you know, absolute. The wali faqih, by default, regardless, has to look at the socio-political impact of this thing. He doesn't have a choice, he has to, this is his job, right? So when the wali faqih makes a ruling that is of something in the socio-political realm, according to so many of the maraji, and I've got references here I can give you. I'll give you. Aghai Makarim Shirazi, he says that if the Hakim Shah or the wali faqih says X, then you have to follow the wali faqih in this regard. If it's a subject within the socio-political arena, the subject of tatbir is within the socio-political arena. No one can dispute that.
Because it's a bit complicated concept. I just want to ask one thing that you can add in this answer. For example, there are 101 marajay taqleed, and on the top is waliyyul faqih. If all 100 give one fatwa on a certain thing, but can the Waliye Faqih's fatwa supersede
those
100 people?
Yes.
Can you please elaborate on this one?
Yes.
I think that's the misconception.
I was actually coming to that. Sorry. The whole reason why the Wali Faqih's position is different and why the weight of responsibility on the Wali Faqih is so much greater is because he's not looking just for his muqallideen. His muqallideen, of course, having muqallideen, doing work for your muqallideen, giving the rulings for your muqallideen, this is serious. It's not something small. But if you multiply that by an order of magnitude, even then you haven't got half of the responsibility of the wali faqih. The wali faqih's responsibility is very close to the responsibility of the imam. It is not the responsibility of the imam, if anyone misunderstands me. It is not the imam. The wali faqih is not the imam ma'soom, no. He is the na'ib of the Imam Ma'soom, and he is not a na'ib khas, because we don't have a na'ib khas. Na'ib khas means special, like specific, like the four nawab we had for Imam Mahdi. He is still a general na'ib. He is a general representative of Imam, in a similar way to the rest of the maraji. But because he has a certain position, because he is the head of the state, if you like, because he is aware of the impact of any Islamic issue upon the rest of the Muslims, things we wouldn't even think about, things we wouldn't be aware of sitting in England, we're worried about our own situation over here. We don't think about the situation, for example, in Madagascar, for example, or in Burma, or in wherever, I don't know, all of these places. We try and keep up with what's happening, we try and keep up with what's going on in the news, but we can't keep everything around. Imam Khamenei, his job, he has a mas'uliyah, a responsibility to Allah, that he has to keep aware of what's going on. He has to know exactly what's going on. So when he gives a ruling, he has to make sure that it doesn't damage anyone, and it doesn't damage Islam, more importantly, in any angle. It doesn't give any loophole for the enemies to come in and damage Islam. Because the enemies, first of all, we know the enemies are way more than us. This is why, wallahi, when I got these phone calls today where people were saying terrible things, very bad words, it upset me, not because they were saying something bad about me. That's, Allah knows how I am, and Allah is my judge. I don't care how someone says about me. What hurts me is that because of me, my Muslim, my Shia brother, is committing a big sin by making tawmat on my parents, by making la'an on me. This is something bad for him. As my brother, why should he do that? When I say to my Muslim brother, Assalamu alaikum, it means everything about that you've got, as my Muslim brother, my Shia brother, is my protection. if I have to, for my Shia brother, I will take bullets. And it is my honor to take those bullets, if I can defend my Shia brother. Whoever the Shia brother is, wherever he is, even if I first time I met him, even if I didn't meet him before, this is my duty, because this is what Karbala taught us. Right? I follow the Marja and the Wali Faqih, because it is the only way that I feel, and that my teachers have given me the information to understand, it is the only way I can be sure that I'm working to the best way to make sure that none of my actions are harming any Muslim brother. For example, I'll give you a story that one brother told me. It's a Pakistani brother from, I think, Woking he was. His family, they have a business in Dubai, I think in Sharjah or somewhere. And they bring a lot of stuff in from places like Parachinar. They're, you know, Shia people. And they bring lots of Shia people in for business. And, you know, every year, you know, they send them back for vacation. You know, normal, just like how it works everywhere. One year, one of the brothers who is from Parachinar, he went back for his vacation to visit his family. And he never came back. So the van, he was concerned of what's going on. How come he hasn't come back? What's going on? What's the problem? What's happened to him? And he found out, he actually traveled to Parachinar, to the guy's house, the family's house. And the family told him something, wallahi, it'll break your heart. These Wahhabi, fasiqeen, zalimeen, they killed him, they murdered him, they massacred him. They chopped his head off. They left his head in a bag outside the door, and on that bag they placed a USB stick, and they said that because the Shia do this, we will kill the Shia. Do you know what was on that USB stick? On that USB stick was a speech by somebody called Yasser Habib. And you know what he said in that speech? In that speech he was making la'an to people. He was making la'an to some of the wives of the Prophet and to some of the Ashab. Imam Khomeini, after this event and many other events, Imam Khamenei rather, issued a fatwa, a very famous fatwa, where Imam Khamenei said that it is haram to insult and make tuhmat and slander the Ashab of our brothers of the Sunnah, or symbols that they hold, that they have respect for. And it is haram to insult the wives of the Prophet. Now that doesn't change the fact how we feel about certain wives of the Prophet. It doesn't suddenly make them like they've finished, they've not done anything wrong. No! This is not what it means. It means we as Shia, especially we as Shia, and of course that we have to even say this, this should be known by us. We as Shia, lovers of Imam Mahdi, people who understand Karbala, because every year we meet about it, we discuss it. We should know that our actions have consequences. How will any of you feel if because of your action, one brother of yours has even a scratch on his face? It's heartbreaking. How can you take it? When I said what I said yesterday, I made a mistake by using the word zina. And I genuinely apologize for that. My reasoning for doing it was sound. I knew why I was doing it. I didn't anticipate the way it would be understood. This is a shortcoming on my part for two reasons. Number one, I believe my English might be faulty. It wasn't clear enough. And secondly, I should understand how the community is. I don't understand. Obviously, you people are from a different culture to where I am from, right? In my culture, for example, the word zina does not mean like rape. It means adultery. I understand it as adultery, right? Of course, it's still not a good thing, of course. But the understanding is different. I didn't understand the cultural sensitivity, and that was a mistake on my part. And genuinely, hand on heart, I apologize if I upset anyone with that. That was not my intention. I have not come here. I have come here only to serve. I have come here because it is my duty. Right? Thank you. Can ask the community. I don't even ask.
So thank you very much for that. Just one more, of course, clarification for the general public.
Please.
As Brother Ahmed Abbas has pointed out, and you have confirmed that, that if there is a fatwa which is not, confirming Agha Khamenei's fatwa, then Agha Khamenei's fatwa takes precedence, and it supersedes that.
But if we
in light of that, can you explain for us what exactly is the idea of taqlid then? Because if any fatwa of any other mujtahid is superseded by the top mujtahid, why everybody shouldn't do taqlid of Agha Khamenei? Why to have other 100 people to do taqlid?
I understand your point. And first of all, it is only rulings in the socio-political arena that are affected by this. Only rulings in the socio-political arena. So, masalan, for example, let's say we'll say Ayatollah X and Ayatollah Y, just to be, to try and clarify it. Let's say Ayatollah X is a marja, a senior marja, and Ayatollah Y is a wali faqih. For example, just bear with me, okay? If I make taqlid of Ayatollah X, who is the marja has different rulings to the wali faqih in matters of, for example, fasting. For example, right? He says that the fast starts immediately at imsak, whereas Ayatollah Y says no, it starts 10 minutes after imsak. For example, I'm taking a simple example, right? Or he says that, for example, when you're looking for the moon for the beginning of the month, you can use a telescope, and the other Ayatollah, the Wali Faqih, says no, you can't use a telescope. For example, right? In those matters, because they don't affect society's image across the whole globe, right? The ruling of the marja is sound. You can continue following the marja, no problem, right? If, however, the matter is something different and it has a socio-political component, like tatbir, because our enemies have used tatbir against us, they have killed our children because we do tatbir, right? We have to understand that there are implications and consequences. Because of this, the ruling of the Rahbar, of Imam Khamenei, supersedes all the marriages. But only that ruling. It doesn't mean you have to follow the Rahbar in every ruling. Unless, of course, you make a taqlid, which is different. But if you make taqlid of Masalan, Alai Sistani, Alai Wahid Qarasani, any other marja, you continue following that marja. And that's good, that's fine. Your khums money, for example, every year when you calculate your khums and everything, you don't send it to the wali faqih, you send it to your marja's representative. And your marja organizes whatever needs to be done with that. If you want to send sadaqat or anything you want to do, any questions you have about fiqh, you write to your marja. Of course, you can write to the wali faqih just to get his opinion so you know. But your first point of contact is the marja. And that's very important. And we are blessed in this day and age. We have something like, I can't remember the exact number, but I think it's eight, maybe nine different maraja across the country. This is amazing. Back in the day, you were lucky if you had one, or if you knew of one, because the way the world was. Now in this day and age, all of the maraja, they have their websites, they have accessible, you can contact them on email, you can even phone them quite easily. Of course, you won't get the marja directly, but you get his office. So does that help?
It does, but it creates a bit of doubts, to be honest.
Let me just clarify one point. I apologize. If someone does not recognize the authority of the wali faqih, right, and they want to continue following what their marja is saying, this is fine. That is something, of course, they're answerable to Allah about it, and they have to be aware that they are answerable. But if they feel that they're going to continue following their marja and not follow the wali faqih's ruling, it's fine. It's their choice. The wali faqih doesn't have a gun pointed to them saying, you must follow what I'm saying. No. Right? There's no pressure or anything. Right? Maybe my mistake, and I'm young, I'm inexperienced. Right? My mistake was the way I presented it. I didn't present it eloquently enough. And I allowed room for shaitan to come and make doubts between brothers. And this was my mistake. And wallah, genuinely, sincerely, I ask forgiveness from you, from Allah, and from Imam Mahdi. Because at the end of the day, as a Hausa student, we come into the employ of Imam Mahdi. And it's my responsibility. If I've done something wrong,
Thank you very much, and I specifically appreciate that you have apologized in front of the whole community. It's just that, you know, the way you explained the merger of Waliya Faqih, he looks at the socio-political. It's not the social and politics, it's the strategic, it's cultural, and everything he has to look after, because he is leading in that.
But the key area...
But you gave an example. I'm not, you know, trying to pick up on that specific example of, you know, moon sighting and all that. It has made us a laughing stock in the society, because a wife is following one merger and keeping a rosa on a day, and the man is not keeping a rosa and he's doing Eid. So I'm still not clear with the point of Brother Ahmed Abbas, which you confirmed that the fatwa of Waliya Faqih overtakes the fatwa of Adam Maraja.
If the matter of moon sighting, right? If the matter of moon sighting, I apologize.
Just a moment. I'm being asked by the committee members to leave. If you agree, I leave and we can continue.
Just allow
it is for the public. It's not for you five boys to, you know, five people to clarify Adam. It's for the public. They're going to take a wrong message home. That's why, you know, somebody has to stand up and speak. It takes time.
Bhai Ahmed, let the Maulana sahab get on with his speech, please. He's apologized. This end of story, isn't it?
Can I also get an apology from those people who made la'an on me and made tahmat on my parents?
They should apologize to him. Absolutely.
Can you please tell them? A'udhu billahi min shaitan rajim. Bismillahir rahmanir rahim. Alhamdulillah rabbil alameen. Wa salatu wa salamu ala sayyidina Muhammad. وعلى أهل بيته الطيبين الطاهرين. ولعن الله ولا أعداء المجمعين من الأولين والآخرين آمين يا رب العالمين. السلام عليك يا أبا عبد الله وعلى الأرواح التي حلت بفنائك. عليك مني جميعا سلام الله أبدا ما بقيت وبقي الليل والنهار. ولا جعل الله آخر الأهد مني لزيارتكم. السلام على الحسين وعلى علي بن الحسين وعلى أولاد الحسين وعلى أصحاب الحسين. السلام عليكم جميعا ورحمة الله. If you remember, if you cast your mind back to the first program, the first session that we had together over here, I mentioned very briefly the situation of Muslim bin Aqil as he was sent as the Naib of Imam Hussein to Kufa. And the events that happened in Kufa, I glossed over them very, very briefly. Because the subject of the whole incident surrounding what happened to Muslim bin Aqil, and then later on what happened and how the whole situation was with Mukhtar al-Thaqafi, explains for us very clearly and very easily these ideas of taqlid, marja'iyya, and wilayah. Now, I'm not going to be able to explain all of this in the half an hour that we have today. So it's going to take time. It's going to take at least maybe 3, maybe 4, maybe 5 days. So I respectfully ask that if anyone wants to text people and say that I've made a mistake or something, at least have the presence of mind to be patient until I've finished, until the brothers have put the lectures online so that people can make their own decision. I don't want this type of chaos to happen again, for which I have apologized and I sincerely apologize. But I do request that those people who know the people who insulted my parents, who insulted my family, and who made la'an on me, they should go and make istighfar. They have no need to phone me or contact me, but they should make istighfar. Because what they have done is committed a sin, the sin of tahmat. They neither know my parents, nor do they know me. The people who called me in the SMS even had my name wrong. So if we look at the situation of Muslim bin Aqil, Muslim bin Aqil alayhi salatu wassalam was sent to Kufa at which point? When the people from Kufa had been asking Imam to come. The people of Kufa, after the death of Muawiyah, la'anallah alayhi, they wanted Imam to come because the Zu'ama, the elders of the people of Kufa, were Shia. and the majority of the people of the Kufa, were Shia people. They were people, because of course Ibn Ali, his center of government, was Kufa, so they remembered that time. They had that love of Imam Ali, they had that connect. And they wanted to be ruled by Imam Hussein. They wanted Imam Hussein to govern them. They knew the Umayyad regime was despotic, a problematic regime. So when many letters were coming, Imam Hussein, as the leader of the time, he has to do tahqiq. He has to verify what is being said. This is a very important lesson, even for all of us in any situation. When we're in an environment, and for example, we hear lots of things from people. Fulan person said X, Fulan person said Y, Fulan person said Z, whatever. Until we have gone and made tahqiq, we have made research and we have confirmed that this is the case, we cannot make judgment. Any Qazi, you put before him any case, say there's a case of two brothers who have a business and na'uzubillah, they fall out and they have difficulties between each other. If you take it towards the Hakim Shar or a Qazi, that Qazi will say, I want to look at this side, I want to look at this side. Now you sit on the side, I need to do my research. He will send independent people to verify, is this correct, is this correct, is this correct? Is someone trying to, you know, confuse me so they get, you know, a wrong ruling or something? This is, even in the legal system, this is normal. You have to work out what the reality is so that the judge can then make a valid ruling, a correct and fair ruling on a given situation. Imam Hussein, as the Imam of the Muslims, not just the Imams of the Arabs, Imam Hussein was Imam of every Muslim alive. And in fact, every human being, the Imams, their authority is not only for the Muslims or for the Shia. Their authority is universal. Every atom in existence, every atom that we can't even see, has a duty to obey the Imam, regardless. Even if what the Imam is telling that atom is to explode and kill yourself. If the Imam is telling that to the atom has a duty to listen. This is the maqam of imamah. The maqam of imamah is not something small. Salawat. So when many letters came from Kufa, and even the surrounding villages of Kufa, the surrounding tribes of Kufa, that, ya Aba Abdullah, please come, you know, rule us, govern us, give us that beauty of the government of Ali again. Don't let this tyrant continue to govern us and all of this thing. Imam Hussein had a discussion with Muslim and a few other of the close companions, including Abu Fadl Abbas alayhi salam. He said to them that we've received many of these letters, what do you think? He spoke to other people who knew Kufa, who were from that land. Imam Hussein, of course, he's from Hijaz. He's from Medina. He is not from Kufa, even though he's aware, but he has to know what the situation is over there. So he said that, okay, Muslim, you have colleagues, you have friends, you have acquaintances, people who you know in Kufa. You go to Kufa and verify these letters. Tell me if when these people are inviting me, are they for real? Or are they just saying it, but they don't have the backbone to stay with it? Because they may be real when they're writing the letter. Imam is not disputing their sincerity when they're writing the letter. Imam is concerned whether they have that strength and that ability to be patient, even when Ubaydullah ibn Ziyad rahimahullah alayh comes along and starts killing them tak-tak, one by one. Imam needs to be sure that these people are going to be muhkam, they're going to be solid, they're not going to falter. So the Imam makes Muslim bin Aqil his na'ib, and gives Muslim bin Aqil that authority to collect the bay'ah on his behalf. When someone has the authority to collect the bay'ah on the behalf of the Imam, that same person has the authority to give rulings on behalf of the Imam. The maqam of the na'ib is not a small maqam. And a na'ib doesn't become a na'ib just like this. It's a maqam. And Allah is the one who makes intikhab of this. So Muslim bin Aqil, he went to Kufa. He went to Kufa, and of course we know the first place where he stayed was the house of Mukhtar ibn Abi Ubaidah al-Thaqafi, alayhi salatu wassalam. Interestingly, and this is something not many people maybe are aware of, maybe you guys are aware of it, I wasn't aware of it when I first read it. When the letters were being written to Imam Hussein, Mukhtar was in the meeting with all of the Zu'ama. Mukhtar was with all of the Zu'ama, they'd invited him. He was another elder, he was one of the elders of the Thaqif tribe. So of course they invited him, they said, we know you're the representative of this tribe. And the name I mentioned previously was Sulaiman ibn Surat al-Khudai. Sulaiman was one of the most senior Zu'ama, one of the most senior leaders in Kufa among the Shia. You could say he was like a senior mushtahid, if you like. People would consult him when they had matters of fiqh, because he had studied, he was aware, he was, you know, aware of the rulings of Islam. He was close, he had been close to Amir al-Mu'mineen and all of this stuff. So he had knowledge. He was not someone, you know, ordinary. He was an alim, no doubt about it. He was a senior alim. Sulaiman said that we are tired of this rule of Banu Umayyah. We should call on Abdullah and we should ask him to come. Mukhtar is sitting there, he's looking at all of these people. Mukhtar, of course, he knows Kufa very well. And all of these people pass around a paper. Sulaiman writes in the paper that, Ya Aba Abdullah, I want you to come, you know, we want you to come, we're ready to give you our bay'ah, we're ready to support you, everything. And he told all of the other elders of the tribes that on behalf of your tribe, place the mohr on this, you know, sign this letter basically. You speak on behalf of your tribe, so you sign this letter. So the letter went around from one person to another. When it came to Mukhtar, Mukhtar said, I don't have my mohr with me. I don't have my mohr with me, and he didn't sign it. He left. When I was reading this in Tariq al-Tabari, I thought, why did Mukhtar do that? This is very interesting. All of the Shia are calling the Imam. If you and me were in that position, man, I would be saying, yeah, come on, man, let's call the Imam. Ya Allah, let's quickly, let's call him. Even let's go drive and get him even. You know, if we've got an opportunity to be with the Imam, come on, you know, who's going to miss out on that? Right? But Mukhtar, he chose not to sign that letter. His reasoning was very simple, and we'll come to his reasoning later on. You will see why his reasoning was probably the most sound. But coming back, Muslim bin Aqil, when he came to Kufa, he stayed with Mukhtar. And one of the first questions after he's recovered from the journey and everything, because the journey of Muslim bin Aqil from Hijaz to Kufa was very difficult. It was very, very difficult. People were scared that maybe something has happened to Muslim on the way, because it took nearly two, according to some riwayat, three times the normal time it would take. And Muslim had come out of Medina with two companions who knew the way in the desert, because the desert it's a difficult place. And both of those people had passed away on the way. Muslim was alone, he was wandering the desert, not really knowing which way to go. When he managed to finally get into Kufa, and it was actually some of Mukhtar's companions who went looking for him because they became concerned, they found him and they brought him. So after he recovered and everything, and Mukhtar has a chance to sit down with him, they sit down and they're discussing. Muslim says to him, that what is the situation of the Muslims, of the Shia in Kufa? Advise me, you are from Kufa, tell me what is the situation of the Shia. Mukhtar said, the Shia, there's many Shia, but the Shia don't have strength, they don't have staying power. They haven't got that force of will to stay on the course. If pressure is applied on them, it's easy for them to buckle. It's easy for them to break and forget their principles for a short time. They'll repent afterwards, but they will break. Mukhtar said this to them. Said this to Muslim bin Aqil. Muslim bin Aqil, of course, understood what Mukhtar was saying. Muslim bin Aqil, of course, he wasn't someone small either. He was raised in the presence of Imam Ali. He was like the brother of Imam Hussein. He was the cousin. Even though he's the son of Aqil, the brother of Amir al-Mu'mineen, he's still close family. He was still not someone, you know, trivial. Khair, Muslim is inside the house of Mukhtar, but it's becoming difficult. The situation is becoming awkward. And especially for Mukhtar, because of who Mukhtar's wife was. Mukhtar's wife was somewhat troublesome. He had two wives. This is not a Mukhtar number, so we won't go into that detail. Inshallah, if we have an opportunity, we can all benefit from Mukhtar. So Mukhtar advised, in fact, Muslim understood himself that it's better for me to go somewhere else, to someone else's house. And also in Mukhtar's house, it was not easy for people to come and visit. Because remember, just after Muslim has arrived, Ubaydullah ibn Ziyad had played a very clever trick on the people of Kufa. The people of Kufa already have heard Muslim bin Aqil saying that I am the Naib of Imam Hussein, and I'm, you know, confirming what you people have said. And of course Muslim was given an impression by the people that we are on your side. We are ready for the Imam, labbaik, you know, we want to help the Imam. So Muslim had sent a qasid to the Imam saying, okay, it looks like everything is okay, so please, fadlallah, please come. When Ubaydullah ibn Ziyad came, the people were completely bemused. They were lost. They were hoodwinked, if you like, by Ubaydullah, because he played a very clever game. And one thing we should always do is never underestimate the enemy. It's a mistake to underestimate the enemy. Always know your enemy. Know your enemy better than the enemy knows you. Because I can tell you one thing for sure. In this day and age, the Zionists, they know the Shia system. They know Shia Islam better than we do. SubhanAllah, if they were Shia, maybe some of them would be senior maraja. The level of knowledge they have, no, really. These people know us so well, but we know nothing about them. This is our shortcoming. For example, I'll give you, I always, in my sessions, I like to bring up characters from the Islamic resistance because it's nice to remember Shuhada, it's thawab to remember Shuhada, but also it's nice to remember Shuhada from our time. One person, someone I mention very often, someone who is very close to my heart, someone who I consider like my elder brother, is Shaheed Imad Mughniyeh. Shaheed Imad Mughniyeh, he made a point of learning Hebrew. He knew Hebrew inside out. When he spoke Hebrew, he spoke like them. When he knew English, when he spoke English, I was telling one of the brothers in the earlier days, when he spoke English, he spoke with a London accent. If you spoke to him, you'd think this is a fella from London. And yet he's never lived in London. But he worked. He made that effort. He pushed himself to make sure he learns. How? Because then when he discusses with them, or when they're speaking something, he can work out what they're saying. He understands their mannerisms. He understands how they operate. Salawat. Now, Ubaydullah ibn Ziyad, he found out that Muslim is already in Kufa before he arrived. When he was nominated by Yazid to take over from Nu'man ibn Bashir, he already knew, he had information that this is the situation. Muslim bin Aqil is there. Muslim bin Aqil is rallying the people. The people of agreed to be with him, and there is a danger of a qiyam, you know, a revolution happening, Kufa. So he spoke to some of his advisors, and he said, I have a plan. These people, not one of them has seen what Hussein ibn Ali looks like. They don't know who Hussein ibn Ali is. Except, of course, people like Muslim and Mukhtar, a few people, but the people in the street, the Joe public, if you like, they don't know what Hussein is like, but they know certain sifat, they know certain characteristics of how Imam Hussein will be dressed, how he will walk, and all of this stuff. So he got him and his troops to dress in the green amama, to wear the black cloak, to wear the clothes of Bani Hashim, so that it would be clear to anyone that this must be Bani Hashim people coming. So when the people, the watch people on the city gates, if you like, of Kufa, when they saw that there's this caravan coming, and this caravan, they're wearing green amama, they're riding this type of horse, they've got this type of everything, they said, Jah Hussein ibn Ali, Imam Hussein has come, Imam Hussein has come, Imam Hussein has come. And they became excited, just like you and me would. Imagine tomorrow we hear that Imam Mahdi has come. Imagine that excitement, that passion we would have. That passion would be amazing. We would not be able to control that. We would be very moved. We want, the Imam is coming. This is, it's Eid, you know? So the people, they came out in all masses to greet the Imam. Muslim bin Aqil knew it wasn't the Imam, and he was telling people, don't, this is not the Imam, be careful. Mukhtar was saying the same thing. Many of the senior people were saying, no, this is a trap, this is a trap. If the Imam was coming, the Imam would send a qasid to us first, he would advise us. This is not the Imam coming. We know that this is not the Imam. But the people didn't listen, because of course they followed there. They had certain qualities that they saw, and they said, well, we know better. We know better than the Zu'ama, than the Na'ib of the Imam, who's lived with the Imam. Anyway, when Ubaydullah came in, he came all the way to the palace, and even Nu'man ibn Bashir became scared. Nu'man ibn Bashir, who was the governor in that time, he became scared that, oh dear, it looks like Hussein has come, I'm in trouble. What am I going to do? Imam Hussein's come, you know, I don't follow Imam Hussein. I can't let him come into the Darul Hukuma. I can't let him come into the palace. What am I going to do? So Nu'man comes to the top of the balcony, and he looks down on the person and he says, who are you and what do you want? Plain ignorant. Of course, he thought it was Imam Hussein as well, but plain ignorant. At that point, when all of the Kufians are around and they're all waiting for the Imam, who they think is the Imam, to make the first speech or something, Ubaydullah ibn Ziyad removes the veil from his face, because he had covered his face. He removed the veil from his face, and the people knew Ubaydullah ibn Ziyad, because they knew what he had done in Basra to the Shia. Ubaydullah ibn Ziyad has never been even 1.00001% a friend of the Shia. He has had the blood of the Shia on his hands from day zero, from the first. He is one of the most mala'in people. And the people in Kufa, they knew Ubaydullah. They were not fans of Ubaydullah. They knew what he meant, what he was about, what he would do. And all these people had exposed themselves as being lovers of Hussein. They had revealed, essentially, you could say, they've revealed all of their cards to the enemy. I'm going to stop over here, and we do, inshallah, a small musibah, because it's Muharram, it's not nice to end a majlis without a musibah. So if we can we dim the lights a little bit? Sallallahu alayka ya Aba Abdullah. Sallallahu alayka ya Ibn Rasulullah. One time Rasulullah, he was walking with a companion called Mazahir. He stopped and he sat on the ground. Rasulullah called Mazahir's young son Habib, and he hugged and kissed him. Mazahir asked Rasulullah, he said, Ya Rasulullah, what good deed has my son done for you to give him such affection? Rasulullah had tears in his eyes and he replied, O Mazahir, whilst we were walking, I happened to notice at Habib, he was walking behind my grandson Hussein. And wherever Hussein stepped, he lifted the dust from under Hussein's feet and put it to his eyes in respect. Ya Mazahir, this Habib will come to my Hussein's aid one day. Habib ibn Mazahir was roughly the same age as Abu Abdullah and Hussein, so roughly in their 60s. They were friends from childhood. When Imam Ali had moved the capital from Medina to Kufa, Habib also moved to Kufa. He stayed in Kufa and he became one of the famous people in Kufa. The first letter which was independent of the one that was sent by Sulaiman, which was sent to Imam Hussein inviting him to Kufa was signed by Habib ibn Mabahir. After Muslim bin Aqil and Hani ibn Urwa were made shaheed by Ubaidullah ibn Ziyad, la'anallah alayh, Kufa was sealed off. And the important thing to Muslim bin Awsajah and Habib ibn Mabahir was to get the information to Imam Hussein that this has happened. Ubaidullah at that point had started spreading a rumor that Imam Hussein has gone to Medina and that he was living happily under the protection of Yazid, na'uzubillah. Even Imam Hussein's messenger, who tried to take a letter to the citizens of Kufa, who was coming from Imam, was arrested outside Kufa before he could bring the letter. He was tied, he was gagged, and he was thrown. Ubaidullah ibn Ziyad succeeded in spreading terror inside the city of Kufa and making the people completely silent. Habib was heartbroken. Habib and Muslim ibn Awsajah, they wanted to join Aba Abdullah al-Hussein. They felt it was their duty to join Aba Abdullah al-Hussein because they had to warn Imam Hussein not to come to Kufa, as Kufa would sign his death. Muslim ibn Awsajah and Habib, they both knew the salt marshes outside of Kufa, the marshland, which is very difficult to go through. Most people, they cannot travel through it. It's all water and it's swampy type land. They came out from Kufa from this direction. But since the day Aba Abdullah al-Hussein had reached Karbala, every day Sayyidina Zainab salamullahi alayha saw soldiers coming to join the camp of Umar ibn Sa'ad la'anallah alayhi. She then came to Imam Hussein and says, "Ya Akhi, why are these soldiers coming?" Imam Hussein replied to her, "My dear sister, they are gathering to kill me." Bibi Zainab says, "My dear brother, you've got hardly 72 men, while they've got thousands." Bibi Zainab had tears in her eyes and she added, "Don't you have anyone to come to your assistance?" "My sister Zainab, many have wanted to join me during this journey from Medina to Karbala. I politely discouraged them," Imam Hussein is saying, "because their intention was not khalisane, it wasn't pure, it wasn't the right intention. Many have joined and many have run because they were scared of dying." He continued, "Zainab, my sister, falsehood can buy many supporters, but truth only has a handful. The soldiers on the other side have been bought with gold. They prefer the happiness of this world than the everlasting glory of Akhirah. My 72 mu'min, truthful men, prefer happiness in this world, in the world that is to come. And that is why they are here with me." In Karbala, Imam Hussein called no one for help except his childhood friend Habib ibn Mabahir. That very same day, Imam wrote a letter to Habib. By this time, Habib had already come out. He wrote to Habib, telling him how Yazid and the Muawiyah's vultures were gathering to try and kill him. The letter was carried by a messenger who entered Kufa by dark, very carefully, in a very dangerous situation. He got to Habib's house, and Habib's wife told him, "Habib has already gone." After Habib and Muslim ibn Awsajah, the two of them came together, after they had slipped out of Kufa, when they went through the marshes, they reached a place where Habib had some horses. They quickly mounted on the horses, and Habib told his servant, the person who was looking after the horses for him, he says, "Go, I am freeing you because of this service, and you are free to go." The servant of Habib said to him, "You are not being fair. I have served you faithfully for years. Now I have a chance to serve the son of Fatima Zahra, and you're asking me to leave you? Why are you denying me a place in heaven?" Habib was taken back by the words of his servant.
He was happy, he was overjoyed to hear that he had recognized the difference between truth and falsehood. He wanted to sacrifice his life for truth. Habib asked his slave to mount the horse. Together, him with Muslim ibn Awsajah, the three of them galloped towards the land of Karbala. Habib reached Karbala late in the evening. In Karbala, Imam Hussein was distributing the weapons to the Mujahideen. There was one spear left. There were two spears left. One he put aside and said, "This is for Muslim ibn Awsajah. He will be coming." Someone asked him, "Yadna Rasulullah, this last sword that you are holding on to, who is it for and why do you hold it so close to you?" Imam Hussein replied, "This is for my childhood friend Habib." Just then Habib could be seen coming towards the camp. Imam Hussein came forward to greet him with great affection. Sayyidah Zainab asked Lady Fizza to find out who has arrived when there was the sound of horses. Every time Bibi Fizza would announce the arrival of more enemy troops, suddenly she said to Sayyidah Zainab that our guest has arrived. Sayyidah Zainab asked Bibi Fizza to convey her salam to Habib. Can you imagine what a maqam Habib had that Sayyidah Zainab salamullahi alayha is giving salam to? When Habib received the message, he began to cry, say, "How fortunate are the companions of Hussein that the daughter of Fatima Zahra should honor them with the greetings." Days and nights of Muharram passed, my brothers and sisters, ajarakumullah. At dawn, Ali Akbar gave Adhan for the last time. Yazid's soldiers blew the trumpet of war. One by one, the companions went to the battlefield and gave their lives for the sake of truth and Islam. Between Dhuhr and Asr, Habib ibn Mabahir came to Imam Hussein. He said, My master, Ya Aba Abdullah, let me go to the battlefield. Let me sacrifice myself for the sake of Islam." Imam says, Habib, my childhood friend, stay with me. You are a comfort to me, my brother, my friend." Habib persisted with his request. He insisted. Eventually, Imam Hussein granted him permission. Imam Hussein mounted, helped his friend Habib onto the horse. Habib ibn Mabahir rode into the battlefield. Ibn Mabahir was not a small family. He was known to be a brave warrior. He fought very bravely, overpowering many of the enemy troops, sending many of them to Jahannam. But finally, he was overpowered and he fell to the ground. Imam Hussein rushed towards Habib. Habib looked at the Imam and says, "O grandson of the Holy Prophet, please forgive this humble servant for not being able to give more than his unworthy life for you and Islam." Imam Hussein took Habib in his arms and cried, Oh my friend. Habib, the honorable Habib, he died resting his head upon the shoulder of Aba Abdullah. Later, and I don't know if you can bear this, later an enemy soldier came over and cut his head. All of the martyrs of Karbala had their heads cut off, but Habib was the first to be cut off by the enemy. Habib's head was not hung on the spears like that of the other martyrs. Habib's head was tied to the horse and it was pulled along the land of Karbala. When the caravan of prisoners reached Kufa, the soldier from Yazid's army who had the head of Habib around his horse saw that a young boy called Qasim was following him wherever he went. He asked the young boy what he wanted. Qasim looked at the head hanging from the horse's neck. The man asked, "Why are you staring at this head?" The boy replied, "This is the head of my father, Habib ibn Mabahir. Please give it to me so I can bury my father's head." Habib's head seemed to look at his son and say, My son Qasim, you are thinking of burying my head. What about the head of Aba Abdullah al-Hussein that sits atop the lance? وَسَيَعْلَمُ الَّذِينَ ظَلَمُوا أَيَّ مُنْقَلَبٍ يَنْقَلِبُونَ إِنَّا لِلَّهِ وَإِنَّا إِلَيْهِ رَاجِعُونَ رِضًا بِقَضَائِهِ وَتَسْلِيمًا لِأَمْرِهِ. Ya Allah, for the sake of this small aza, we ask you to give health and success to all of the mu'mineen. We ask you to grant all of the hajat, the halal hajat of all of the believers. We guide you. We ask you to guide all of the believers towards the right way and to increase our knowledge and to increase our affection and love for Ahlul Bayt and for Imam Mahd. We ask you, O Allah, to help us become more steadfast in following the commandments of the righteous Maraji and the Wali Faqih. Ya Allah, we ask that you make us among the choice companions of Imam Mahdi Ajalallah Ta'ala Farajahu Sharif, and that you honor us as being among those people who become shaheed under his command. Ya Allah, we ask you to protect all of the Muslims from the east to the west, from Pakistan to Palestine, from Bahrain to Saudi, to occupied Arabia, to Syria. Ya Allah, we ask you to destroy the zalimeen, to reduce them to dust. Ya Allah, we ask you to avenge the blood of the pure blood that was shed in Karbala. Ya Allah, we ask you to hasten the return of Imam Mahdi. Ya Allah, we ask you to protect all of the maraji, all of the senior ulama, and especially the leader, Sayyid Ali Khamenei. Allahumma balligh arwah al-mu'minina wal-mu'minat, Surat al-Fatiha, ma'as-salawat.